He's John Draginis. I'm Paul Reese, and you are listening to Double Underscore. Hey, John, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing just dandy. The weather's warming up here, and just got back from a really nice vacation with the family, so I'm just living my best life.
Oh, that sounds lovely, especially the warm part. It's about time we get this cold weather behind us.
You know, it was a mild winter here in Wisconsin, so I don't know. I can't complain too much, but I agree. I'm looking forward to summer.
Well, John, this is our opening episode, our inaugural recording of the Double Underscore podcast. It's great to finally be on the air with you.
It's wild. It feels like this has been forever in the making. Not that our maybe listeners know that, if anyone listens to us.
No, we don't need to advertise how long we've been planning this podcast. We're just going to focus on the fact that it's here now. Here we are.
It's
welcome.
Here. It's here. You've all been waiting for it. Yes. And by all, I mean my grandma, my mom, my wife.
Yes, all of our closest relatives have been asking us how long it's going to take. Well, hey, John, this being our first episode, we are releasing. One of the questions I wanted to address right up top is, why do yet another Salesforce podcast? There are tons of Salesforce, maybe not tons, but there's a lot of Salesforce podcasts out there. There's a lot of great YouTube content, great content in blogs, and there is no shortage of Salesforce-related content. So what are we doing this for? I'm going to turn it over to you to get your answer to that first, John.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to answer more of the how we got here and a little bit about why we're doing it too. I mean, I think for me, right, part of why we're doing it is because we're just nerds and we love Salesforce. We love all things Certinia and the Salesforce platform. We just have a great time with it. But I mean, to me, it really started, Paul. We've been working together for what, 3 years at this point?
About that, yeah.
Yeah. And we've went from working together to you managing me for a while, and now we're peers, and we've had a lot of fun doing it. And I think, you know, had all these just like late night conversations, you know, when we probably should have been done working and not thinking about work and just talking about all things consulting, right? The psychology of consulting, the technical pieces of consulting. And we never really recorded any of those. And had to start wondering, like, do other people want to hear this? Like, is there really a Salesforce podcast focus on like consulting methodology and what it means to be a good consultant, and how do you ask good questions in discovery? How do you deal with conflict in projects? How do you tackle big customizations and testing and just all the different things that come along with, you know, kicking off a project to getting a customer successfully live, right? And I feel like we've talked about so many of those things on our own and realized, hey, maybe there's an audience that also wants to learn this as they either start their consulting journey or have been in it for a few years and just want to listen to what other people have to say about the industry.
Yeah, and I'll add to that, and I'll say there's always places to go to find answers when I'm looking for a technical answer to a technical question. But what I've really struggled to find is people that I work with who do work that's close enough to what I do, similar enough to where we have enough in common that we encounter the same types of scenarios. Because I've been doing this for a while, but I never ever feel like I've got all the answers. And I am the kind of person who likes to just bounce things off of people and say, hey, have you ever run into this situation? And how did you think about it? How'd you approach it? Did that work out? What have you learned? And I'm always trying to learn from people, but just the number of available people who have, you know, similar enough experiences, it's tough, right? And so as you and I started working together, it just became really obvious that, oh, we're interested in the same kinds of problems and the same kinds of, yeah, I can solve for it technically, but is that the right thing to do? You know, those kinds of questions that I think just have to be talked about. So it's really more of a discussion that I'm looking for, and we're already having those kinds of discussions. We just weren't recording them before, and we just thought as we were having these calls, hey, if we're going to be having these calls, we might as well record them and put them out there, because I think there's other people out there who would be interested in having those same kinds of discussions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's fun. Like our journey, I think through like thinking about all things technical to then stepping back for a second being like, just cause we can doesn't mean we should. Like it's been fun to get to that point together. I think of early on in our exploration of like flow automation within Salesforce and, oh, we can do it. We should do it. We should do it. And now it's like, okay, we've learned a lot. Should we always build a flow just cause we can? You know, it's fun to ask those questions.
Right. Right. So maybe let's talk a little bit more, let's not rehash our whole resume, but give people just a sense of our background and where we're coming from and the roles that we play. Just so people know where we're coming from and maybe how much or how little our listeners might have in common and where they might be able to relate to us.
Yeah.
So I'll kick us off. You mentioned that we worked together for a while. So I'm at Certinia. I'm a full-time employee. I'm a solution architect in professional services at Certinia. For those of you who don't know the name Certinia, we were formerly named Financial Force until last year, 2023. We went through a name change to kind of recognize that we're not primarily or strictly financial related. We have lots of other solutions that aren't related to financials. But, you know, I've been here for 4 years. Before I was in the current role I'm in as a solution architect, I was a consulting director. Before I was a consulting director, I was a director of customer success. So I've got some customer success. And before that, I was co-founder of one of our partners doing Certinia, well, formerly Financial Force implementations and building a team as a partner. And so now I'm on the inside and I love what I do. I can never decide on an actual job title for more than a couple of years at a time, but I'm having fun. So that's me. John, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So I feel like this is pretty common when you talk to people in the Salesforce space, but I kind of accidentally ended up in the Salesforce world and I'm coming up on of a decade of experience of the Salesforce ecosystem. So I've been saying that for 4 years. It's actually probably true this year. But you know, you got to build credibility somehow when you're a young consultant.
That's right. You gotta fill your resume with almost X years of,
Yeah, but it's actually true this year. So I went to school for agricultural business, so absolutely not Salesforce consulting. Ended up working my first company as a kind of a data scientist, aka I did a lot of reporting for the CFO. They didn't have an owner of their Salesforce system at the time, and I was like, hey, I could be that person. So I raised my hand. I did a presentation to the C-suite on why they should have a Salesforce administrator / project manager. And I became the Salesforce administrator project manager. Before I did that there, I spent a couple of years working specifically with the professional services team there. So I've been in professional services basically my entire career as well. I was there for, 4 or 5 years and decided administering a system is fun, but I really want to build the car. So I was a customer of Salesforce. I was a customer of Certinia and, you know, a couple of other marketing automation platforms and things like that. And I really liked Certinia. I saw the power of it and being able to kind of build out an entire quote to cash system that I built personally with my CFO when I was at that company and decided, hey, I should go to Certinia and become a consultant. So I reached out and couple months later, I became a consultant at Certinia. I was there for a couple of years, and then I decided to go off on my own. I really liked working with Certinia, a great organization. I still obviously do a lot of work with them and for them, but wanted to kind of experience what it was like to build a small little consulting practice on my own. I haven't started adding employees yet, but I'm just doing some really fun stuff and doing some long-term managed services contracts, as well as, you know, architectural work for Certinia, just really enjoying it too. Like Paul, I've bounced around every couple years, and besides consulting, I created every job that I had, and it didn't exist at the company prior. So, you know, we'll see if I can actually stay doing what I'm doing or if I go do something else, but I love it. It's a good time. I definitely plan on being in consulting for a while. Little known fact, I also own and operate a small little beekeeping business. So, you know, got to get away from the computer somehow.
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite things to talk to you about because I have a phobia of bees. So yeah. That's perfect.
Yeah, they're great. They're friendly.
Yeah, every time you bring it up, I'm just considering it exposure therapy. Exposure therapy.
We'll do a special episode sometime where we do it on video, and it'll be out at the hive.
Oh yeah, in your beekeeper suit. That'll be.
It'll no, you
awake for a week.
You in a bee.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's not going to happen. But, you know, you mentioned in your background something we've both been, you know, on the inside at a company and on the outside as an independent or a partner. And so we've both got kind of differing perspectives on, you know, the role can change a lot based on who you actually work for, who you report to, the size of your organization, your partners, all of those kinds of things. And we're going to get into that in our main topic today. But the format of this podcast is we always want to start with something I learned recently before we get into the good stuff.
Yeah. And I think the reason for that, for what it's worth, is we want you guys to know, like, doesn't matter how long you've been consulting, there's always, always something to learn when you're in the technology consulting space.
Yep, that's right. And sometimes we learn really cool, interesting stuff that nobody we've ever talked to has encountered before. And sometimes we learn things like we feel like we should have learned years and years ago. And that's probably more the theme this week. So you want to kick us off on why don't you start us off on what you've learned recently?
I'm honestly embarrassed to share what I've learned, but I think based on some LinkedIn sleuthing that other people have also just recently learned this. So I'm feeling good. I'm very confident it's not new though, and I should have known this a long time ago. So, you know how in Salesforce reports you can add date filters, obviously, right? Well, there's two options. You can add a specific date or you can add relative date filters, right? With me so far?
I'm with you.
Okay. Well, relative date filters are great. I've been using those for years. I've been sharing them with everybody I work with, every customer. I put it in a little like reports, tips and trick guide that I send them and talk to them about it because they're fantastic. I've always thought there is a gap in relative date filters though, and this is where you're going to maybe laugh at me or maybe also learn. And it's that like you can always say like the next 6 months or the last 6 months or next year or last year. But anytime you do like the next 6 months, there's never been a way to my knowledge, okay, to include the month you're in. So like let's say you want to do this month plus the next 6 months, right? With me?
I'm with you.
Get ready to make fun of me. Okay. So I always thought you had to add two relative date filters. So you'd have to say this month and then do next 6 months. And then basically do advanced criteria, right? Where you do like one or two. Okay. That is not true. You can comma delimit relative date filters.
I'm sorry. I'm just looking for a mind blown sound that I can play, but I don't have my soundboard set up.
Did you know this?
I didn't know it, but I don't think I've ever come across a need for it.
It's really big in sales pipeline reports.
Okay.
Like people are always wanting to do like this month plus X period of time. That's like probably the most common use case. I'm telling you, it's a dumb thing. It's small, but like I just don't know how I didn't know this until like, I don't know, 2 weeks ago.
See, I still think this. Now I want to like log in and put the show on pause and find out and prove you wrong in real time, but I'm not going to do it. I thought that next 6 weeks included this week or next 30 days included today.
It might be for days, but it's not for months.
Not for months. So if you say next 3 months,
yeah,
that's only next month and the subsequent 2 months.
I'm pretty sure.
Oh man, we might have to have a follow-up episode if
we might. If I'm wrong on this, then I'm really, really gonna kick myself in the tail.
Well, you know, but what we'll do is after the recording, we'll go do some quick testing before we release it. And we might just cut out the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Fair enough. So,
but it's just as likely that I assumed it was working and I never looked closely at it. So now you've got me.
The bigger irony is that I just Googled about this and the first idea that came up, like the comment on it, is from one of my customers. Like, what are the odds that I pull up a random idea exchange link and a customer of mine commented on it? Yeah, anyways,
that's wild.
Cool. So anyways, I'll validate. We can cut it if we need to, but keep going.
Well, I'll volunteer mine because it's probably in the same category of something I should have known a long time ago. So I was actually just today working with a customer where we've got dynamic forms on Lightning Pages, where instead of using the old school page layout, you can replace that and define your own kind of custom form to display on the Lightning page. Mm-hmm. So when you do that, I knew that there were limitations with dynamic forms, one of which is to not mix them with an actual page layout. That causes weirdness, which we've talked about before. But what I ran into, and I could not find any documentation to this effect, is everything worked fine looking at the page, but when I opened it in a console, mm-hmm. None of the fields were displayed. It was just a completely empty page. Now, related lists and other, like I had a tab component, and so other tabs were fine, and they were displaying all the related records, but the dynamic forms were just completely invisible. And I could not, no matter what I did, I had like, conditionally displaying certain sections, certain fields. I had rich text components displayed. I had a bunch of things. So I just stripped it down and added just one set of fields in the dynamic form, and it still wouldn't display until I replaced it with the actual page layout. And it's only the console view. So one thing I read was like, if you have the old classic console, they're not compatible with that. But
oh, like not a Lightning ready app or whatever.
Right. Right, because it has to run in, you know, Lightning app. But this is the standard support console that I'm working with. It's not a custom console app. It's definitely Lightning. And I could not find any information about it. So either there's something really obvious that I'm overlooking, which is always possible. That's part of the benefit of doing this podcast, so that we can throw out our dumb questions and maybe our listeners will tell us, oh, here's actually the answer. So hopefully somebody knows this, because I could not figure out how to make it work. Fortunately, the old school layout was fine, but that was weird. Yeah.
I'm not saying this is like comprehensive, because obviously me like not paying attention to you and Googling for 30 seconds in the background, but Salesforce Help doesn't really say anything about it. And I know you said you looked at it, but that's odd. Interesting.
Yeah, I did. They've got articles on like known issues of dynamic forms, limitations of dynamic forms. I poured through all of that. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Interesting. That's an odd limitation.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm still not convinced it's a limitation. I still think maybe there's something I'm doing wrong or overlooking.
Right. I'd kind of expect there to be an idea out there for it if that was a limitation. You know what I mean? I don't know. That feels like enough people use console. I've never liked console for whatever reason, but I know people that use it like love it. So,
right. And I'm dealing with a customer where all of the users are already in support console. So we're just adding some new tabs for them. So it's just no way we're going to ask them to not work within that.
Totally. Totally. Makes sense. It's a worthwhile limitation to know if it's true. Man, you should submit a support case for that. I really want to know the answer.
Yeah, every time I search Google to see, hey, how do I do this, and I find nothing, to me, what that means is I'm doing something obviously wrong, because there's no way I can be the first person who's come across some limitation.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, you never know, but I would agree. I think that's a pretty good barometer if it's nowhere on Google. Google can get you very far in the consulting world.
Definitely. Just 60 seconds of quick Googling and you learn everything you need to know.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, let's move into the main course portion of the episode today. So, given that this is our inaugural episode and we gave a little bit of background about ourselves, one of the differences we highlighted is working as an independent versus working for a company. And John, once again, I'm going to turn this over to you because I think you had something on your mind that you wanted to discuss around this topic.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think it's just an interesting conversation to have because it's something I wouldn't have thought about when I worked for a company as a consultant. But now that I'm off on my own, I think about it regularly just because I think I can observe the differences. And I think I probably even text you about the differences here and there, or more so like questions about, oh, I'm an independent. How should I handle this? So I think to me, when you're an independent, there's just some things that you might do differently to either protect yourself, protect relationships, or to grow yourself, grow relationships. Or to even, I guess, maybe like prevent relationships from growing. That feels less likely to me. I wanted to start off kind of highlighting some of the areas that I think you might look at differently as an independent. And some of it's because you have the freedom to look at it differently. And some of it's just because you're on your own. And so it does change things. So I think I want to start off with talking about how you might consider saying yes or no to really good opportunities when you're an independent consultant, and talk about maybe some of the constraints around saying yes or no and different things like that. So kind of want to give you a little bit of my perspective, but then I'd also love to hear yours. So
all right.
I'll say with specifically that point, when you get asked to do something as an independent, there's a lot more thought behind it. Because one, you can say no a little bit more easily. If you're an employee, you only have so much freedom to say no, depending on the organization you're with, of course. But usually, you know, to a certain extent, when you get asked to take on things, it's kind of like a, hey, you need to take this on. Is there anything we can do to make it happen? I can say no. So I think something that I think about pretty regularly when I say yes or no to an opportunity as an independent is, first off, do I have capacity, right? Like, I'm one person right now, and eventually I hope to be more. But I only have 40 hours in a week. Now, I know people could say, well, you could work less than that, or you can work more than that. And that's true. But to some reasonable degree, I have to plan around a 40-hour week. And the reason for that, right, and you could probably guess, is customers expect me to be able to deliver results during their normal working days for the most part. And they also expect me to be able to take meetings during normal working hours for the most part. Again, there's some exceptions to that, but that's something I need to think about. And then another thing that I think I regularly think about as an independent is, how will taking this opportunity prevent me from saying yes to other things and or help me build the business that I'm trying to build? So I'm going to pause there because I talked a lot. Those are a couple of things that I think about when I'm getting asked to take, you know, new projects, big or small. But curious if you think about any of those things as a employee, or if it's just kind of like, well, yeah, no, I don't really have that choice or that luxury.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely different as an employee. But before we go there, I want to dig in a little bit more. So in your scenario, yeah, let's be clear, who would you be saying yes or no to? Is it the end customer, or is it Certinia, like, which is essentially an intermediary in your world? Is it all the above? Like, to me, that makes a big difference. Who are you saying no to?
Yeah, that's a fair question. So I think there's two pieces of that. And the first one that I'm going to say is most common as a freelancer is like saying yes or no to someone you contract through. So for me, I contract with Certinia. I have contracted with other people, but it's primarily Certinia. I like working with them. And so I've made them the main people that I contract work with. And so I think saying yes or no there is different because I'm not selling myself to Certinia, so to speak, right? I know that sounds weird. Obviously, I have to keep my reputation strong. I want to look good and continue to build relationships. But it's not the same as when I go out to customers directly and I'm selling myself to them like, hey, do you want my services? This is what I can provide. However, I do occasionally have to say no to existing customers, right? Or customers that come to me. So that does happen, but I would say it usually happens for different reasons.
And so the downside of saying no to Sartinia in that case is I guess if you do it too much, too often, or in the wrong way, or for reasons that Sartinia leadership thinks are a little wonky or suspect, or the risk for you is potentially losing or maybe just degrading your relationship, which is a source of some of your work, right?
Absolutely. I think that's a risk, but I think there's also a risk to saying yes at times, besides me maybe potentially having too many hours for a period of time or something like that. I think the risk there lies uniquely in I feel like my relationship and my reputation has to be held at a different regard as a contractor, because they can very easily choose to or not to work with me. And so I want to make sure I'm taking things that I feel like I have a heavy ability to impact the success of.
Right. But I'm going to speak for you a little bit and say, don't you also want something that's going to be where you've got one foot in competence and another foot in, let's say, something new and challenging? Like you want to be appropriately challenged, but also sufficiently grounded in your ability so that it's not just boring work that you've done 20 times.
Totally. And that's an interesting thing to balance too, right? Like if I'm like, this is going to sound bad, but if I'm getting asked to do a smart start, sorry, define that, right? A quick project with a customer that just wants like out of the box software, right? Like I'm not overly likely to say yes to that unless like I just need some work or something like that, just because it's not overly interesting or engaging to me anymore.
Right. It's not challenging. It doesn't really present any new challenges other than potentially human challenges. And those kinds of human challenges are not usually the fun ones.
Yeah. I can't say I particularly like human challenges on quick projects.
Yeah. When people will occasionally say to me, wow, Paul, you handled that customer really well. How'd you do that? And my sort of jokey answer, but I also believe it, is that people are the ultimate puzzle. Yeah, I love technical challenges too, but sometimes I will interact with a customer or a prospect and I find them to be particularly challenging. That's really the nicest way we should probably say it on this podcast, challenging people.
Totally.
And sometimes I'm just like, I don't want to work with that person. Mm-hmm. But more often I'm like, okay, they're coming with some kind of negative expectation or negative attitude. And I have this little game I play in my mind where I'm like, I bet I could turn them. I bet I could make them like me. I bet I could improve their attitude in some way.
Oh, it's honestly so fun.
So there is a,
yeah, that's, yeah.
It's a demented thing that some of us have where we appreciate that challenge, but.
But that's the kind of project that I'll kill myself on, because I will do everything in my power to get that, like, you know, quote unquote 5-star rating at the end.
Yep. Yeah, especially with somebody who started at a zero and then you got them all the way there. Yeah, that's rewarding.
Yeah.
And also often impossible.
I've done it. I have done it.
It could be done, sure.
Yeah, yeah, but it is hard. It is really hard. Yeah. And you'll probably have a couple more gray hairs at the end of it.
And it's not usually the kind of challenge that you're looking for, right? You don't go to somebody and say, hey, you got any projects with some especially difficult people?
Absolutely not. No. No, I don't do that.
So, all right. Now that we have some context in who you're saying no to, you can really afford to say no to, we'll just say generically, your partners, right? Not your direct customers. I think you can afford to say no to them quite a lot, because saying no is really just usually saying I'm not available right now. It's a temporary
right.
no.
Right. Most it's often. Not a, most
it's
often.
Not a, I'm not interested in working with you or anything like that. So to me, the question is, what does each project get you short term and long term? And right. sometimes it can get you really selfish things short term, like, oh, good, that's an opportunity to learn more about a particular product or feature that mm-hmm. I would like more exposure to. And that's right. kind of a selfish short term gain. And then you've got more longer term benefits that you can say, well, if I take on this project, that will allow me to, you know, maybe it's 30 hours a week for 9 months. Okay. there's a benefit to that, which is, you know, you've got money coming in, but then there's also, well, you've got to say no to most every other opportunity coming in for the next 9 months. Absolutely. Everything you say yes to, there's a trade-off for.
Absolutely. And I found that
there's almost always a downside.
The longer I'm independent, because I'm coming up on 2 years here, the more I say no, which is probably makes sense, but also interesting, right? I think I've gotten more strategic about what I say yes to.
And so my approach was different when I was, you know, before I was an employee here, because although I was a partner, I had a company, I had employees. Mm-hmm. And when there was an opportunity that I wanted to say yes to, it was in some cases an excuse to like, oh, well, we'll just build our team. We'll grow our team and then we can say yes. And then that'll be one more project that we can have under our belt for our kind of company resume. And so sometimes saying yes to the thing we didn't have quite enough capacity for or quite the right expertise was an opportunity to get that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think, you know, to that point, when or if I start hiring people, my approach would probably change there, right? Because theoretically, you want to have the work before you get the person to do the work.
Right. And I'm sure there's tons of independent people who deal with that. Well, I could probably do it if I hired somebody, but then what? Now I'm obligated to keep them on and I don't want to hire somebody just for a short-term project. Like that's a tough thing to wrestle with, especially if you're not clear whether you want to hire people.
And it is.
Not everybody is clear.
And I mean, I think to that point, like I think, and this is going way on a tangent, but like, I don't think people have enough respect, and this is, man, so much more respect for people that staff, resource, all that stuff now that I'm on my own. Like, it is very tricky to scale a services business because you're solely selling time, right? It's not like you're selling a product. You're selling people's hours. So it's tricky to scale that.
Yeah, you might even say it's unscalable. You can grow it.
Yeah.
You can grow a services business. I mean, everybody knows that. But how do you actually achieve scale so that as you grow, you gain efficiency? That's in services. You know, that's almost a self-contradiction.
You become less efficient the bigger you get in services.
In some areas you do. Yep.
Yeah, and it's not a result of bad process in some cases, right? It's just the nature of we're now delivering X amount of hours over X number of people, and that's easier when it's 1, 2, 3 people. The impact for losing hours is maybe lower with 100 or 200 people, but...
yeah, there's this mirage that we buy into thinking that there is a perfect size or right size for a services organization. If only I had 5 more people on our team, then we'd be just right. The problem is then you get to those 5 and you realize, oh, we need some more operational costs to improve efficiencies because now we're losing a bunch of the productivity in terms of communication and collaboration. Okay, so let's add that. And then, oh, now we've got to apply those costs across more people because we have more. It's like you never actually get there. I don't believe there is a perfect size. There are ranges of size with different advantages and drawbacks, but I've just never seen a size where you feel like, oh, this is just right. Let's stay this size forever.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with that. I agree with that. So anyways, I mean, I don't know. It's different to say yes to opportunities as a contractor, I've learned. And I guess to your point, you know, maybe we've learned you just don't necessarily have that luxury to a certain extent as an employee. Although I don't know. I mean, I think when I was an employee at Certinia, I had the ability to kind of say yes and no within a range to certain types of things.
Yeah, I just think it definitely is different. First of all, it's curious when an employee wants to decline an assignment, like the reason is really important. So when I was leading a team, you know, I would, before I would assign somebody to a project, I would, you know, including you, I would have a chat first and say, hey, here's what I got. I think it's got some benefits for you here. I think it's got some things you're not going to love here, but this is what it is, and this is why I need you to do it. You don't really have a choice, but I'm still interested in your feedback. You know, it would be more a conversation like that. Or sometimes I might have an actual choice. And if your reason for turning down the assignment was something like, Paul, that's too easy for me. Can you just give me the next challenging one or the next fun one? Or if you said, well, how are the people? Are they easy to work with? Like, well, you don't get to choose based on that, because we don't get to choose based on that. But I think there's plenty of valid reasons. Like, if you're in an organization and you feel like you're getting assignments that aren't right for you, or that they're giving you the quote unquote bad projects, then it's worth a conversation, probably not in context of whether you're willing to accept an assignment or not, but maybe that's a prompt to say, hey, you know what would be really nice for one of my upcoming assignments is an opportunity to do this, or I'm looking to build these type of skills, or I'm looking to travel more or travel less, or like make what's important to you known. And then you can, you know, once you've had that conversation with your manager, you can bring it up at the next assignment and say, yeah, of course I'll take this. But, you know, as we spoke before, it's also, I'm also really interested in these other types of assignments. And so don't forget if those come up, like it's more of a longer term negotiation where you don't own your yes or no for most assignments. With one caveat I'll get to in a second. I think it's really just a matter of it. Trying to make leadership understand where you'd like to be assigned and why. And most organizations are going to want to try to support that because they'd rather keep you, assuming you're good. I think the exception to that is ethical reasons. So this is one of those times where we've got to be really careful not to talk details about actual former customers, but you know, let's say there's a customer who's in an industry that you've got ethical concerns with. Just whatever your personal moral compass is, it says that is an industry that I just have a hard time with. I don't feel comfortable supporting their mission. Depending on what that moral conundrum is, I would probably 99% of the time side with my employee who has an ethical concern, even if it's very different than mine and I don't share that concern. I would never want to put somebody in a situation where they felt like, oh, I'm working with this group and their mission is so counter to what I believe in. I think there's got to be some room for that as long as you don't abuse it, right? If you're ruling out dozens of industries because you're fundamentally, let's say, anti-capitalism, well
I was just going to say, I was literally just going to say capitalism.
Yeah. It's like, no, I'm really looking for more socialist driven companies. Yeah. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's lots of things, whether it be working for maybe government agencies, maybe military, some people have issues with, maybe, you know, animal testing, you know, there's lots of very valid reasons to object ethically.
I know you can't share, but I'm just curious. Have you had this come up before for you?
I have, yeah.
Okay. Well, not recording. I was just curious if that's actually happened for you or not. Nice. Right.
Yeah, it happened, and initially when I was assigned, I wasn't familiar with who the customer was and what the industry they were in. Okay. And by the time, you know, I got up to speed, I was, you know, it was too late to back out. Okay. And I was like, oh, this is what you do. And fortunately for me, like that assignment didn't turn out to be very long. So I was able to, like, I didn't love it, but I was uncomfortable during it. And if I had been pulled deeper into it, then I would have raised my hand and said, actually, I'm really looking more for an exit for this reason. So no, I never had to outright refuse, but I was in a situation that I was like, man, I wish I weren't involved in this particular
project. Okay. That makes sense. I could see that. I could think of some companies I probably wouldn't want to work with, but I haven't had it happen. So
yeah, I think it's pretty rare, but I guess it depends on who you work for and you know, a lot of organizations will kind of specialize or have practices by industry.
Right. Yep. Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty valid reason. I mean, I'm thinking of times I said no when I was a actual employee of a business. And I mean, I think for me, it was for a lot of the reasons you listed, which was I didn't think it was going to be challenging enough, and or I knew that there was another deal coming down the pipeline that seemed like way more appealing, that was potentially going to be more work. And so I'd use that as a bargaining chip, like, hey, I'll take this project to not do this project.
Yeah.
That type of thing. Ironically, one of the first projects I ever got put on at Certinia was because I was the only consultant that knew anything about agriculture, and it was an agricultural customer, and I got put there, and that's how you and I ended up starting to work together.
That's right. And that background came in handy, right? On that project.
It did.
I mean, you...
Yeah.
You knew the industry. You were also in kind of the same region. You had a lot in common, and that definitely helped.
Yeah, I could speak the language a little bit more than probably some people would, which not required by any stretch, but certainly adds value. So.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Did we beat that horse to death?
Probably. There are some other things I was going to bring up, but I feel like we adjacently covered them. So I don't think we need to go there. I think another interesting topic for today that comes up quite often as a consultant is dealing with conflict. And kind of how you go about that. I think, you know, there's conflict with clients, conflict with internal teams, conflicts with leadership. I don't think we need to go deep on this today or anything, but it's an interesting one just to, I don't know, share a little bit more about kind of how we handle work professionally.
Okay. I'm going to start with, something on the, extreme end of the conflict spectrum.
Oh boy.
Which is I was working with a customer at some undisclosed region and time frame, and I was working with more than one female on my project team, and so I think it was two women I was working with, and the customer had a particular person who used a lot of figures of speech that ended up being related to like relationship speak. So here's a couple of examples of the kind of things that this person would say. They would say something like early in the project, look, we're going to be getting to know, we're going to be working together really closely. So it's kind of like we're dating. And when we're dating, and then he would finish the analogy. Not a great analogy to choose in a workplace environment. He said another one, something about, it was a marriage analogy, and when you're married, you know, and it was just too many, of those kinds of references that were just like personal relationship based references. And this person was a man and a, you know, real strong personality, liked to talk over people. And, you know, I could tell, just because I knew the people that I was working with, that they were bothered by this. And I approached one of my colleagues and I said, I'm not really comfortable with the way this guy is talking. This is not appropriate, right? And they said, yeah, I just could really do without those kinds of figures of speech. And I said, okay, let me try to help. So I reported it because, you know, these people were feeling like, this language makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't know if it would legally cross the line of actual harassment. Probably not, but it was enough to where I was concerned for my colleagues. So long story short.
Not professional, right? I think you can
not at least, professional. At least say that's, that. Yeah.
Yeah.
At least it passed that bar. And so I actually got HR involved at the time.
Did you get HR company? With your company or the customer company?
I'm trying to be generic just to leave.
Fair enough. You know, fair enough. Okay. Cool.
I'm trying to not be too specific because I think the anecdote is just about what could happen. But yeah. HR got involved and ended up speaking to the person at the customer and saying, look, the way that you're treating our employees interferes with our standards, and we cannot subject our employees to this kind of work environment. So
yeah.
You need to change.
That's fantastic.
Amazing.
That's really great. Go HR. Like that's a rock star example of how to handle something like that.
Yep. And we put a plan together and we made an agreement. We were very crisp in terms of expectations going forward. And for a somewhat extended period of time, we made sure that, you know, on every call there, that nobody would be alone on a call. Of course, it was all billable. And, you know, we got through it. It was addressed. But if it hadn't been addressed soon, it could have cost us, you know, some really valuable colleagues of mine. And I would have been, you know, I would have been, first of all, in the wrong for not doing something about it. Not that they needed me to do something about it, but I was glad that that worked out. So to me, that was a good example of how conflict, like really uncomfortable conflict, can be addressed. But I most circumstances we find ourselves in are not that extreme. I just, that one came to mind.
Yeah, that's a good one though. And also, like, man, you handled it great. I feel like sometimes conflict doesn't get handled well in projects. I have not handled conflict well. I've seen people not handle conflict well. So, and that's just a good example.
Do you consider yourself conflict averse or a people pleaser?
Oh man, I am certainly a people pleaser, but I am going to weirdly come alongside of that and say that I don't know that I'm conflict averse, which I know feels like it doesn't go together.
So if you think conflict is necessary, you're not particularly too troubled by having to confront it.
No, I will invoke conflict if I think it's necessary.
Oh, good.
And I cannot say that that's always been true, but I think I've learned it enough from other good consultants and like when it's necessary, right? Like there are times to challenge things, and sometimes challenging things creates conflict. You got to be careful about it, right? Like you got to be professional about it. But I've seen, you know, times where challenging internal processes paid off and resulted in positive outcomes, where challenging customer processes paid off. I'm not good at it. I don't want to sit there and act like I'm a pro. I've seen people that are way better at it. But I think to survive in the consulting space, you've got to be okay with creating some conflict at times.
Yeah, or just like fielding it when it comes your way.
Or fielding it when it comes. Yeah, because you're going to face conflict, right?
Sure.
And I think an interesting place where sometimes conflict happens is with leadership, both customer leadership and internal leadership, which that's something I don't know that I expected when I started consulting.
But say more about that. What do you mean?
I don't think I expected I'm going to say specifically with internal leadership. So obviously I can't speak to this as much anymore because I'm on my own, but like, I don't think I expected services teams to have conflict with their own internal leadership on like delivering projects. Does that make sense?
Mm, it does. Yeah.
And the primary place I see it is like good consultants are really passionate about customer success. Like really passionate about customer success. And I think that the way they would approach making sure that happens is, and this isn't necessarily bad, but it's often at odds with how sometimes maybe a leader in the services space would approach making sure that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does. So what do you think is the right expectation that you should bring or anybody should bring to their organization? What should you expect from your leaders when it comes to conflict?
I think it's wise to know going into consulting, you're going to face conflict with leadership internally. And I think the expectation is like, you should not be afraid to argue what you stand for. Like I'm going to use an example. Like there might be times as a consultant where you feel very strongly that a customer needs more hours or needs a bigger timeline. And you might go to a services leader and argue for that. And they might agree with you and they might disagree. I think when you're going to leadership, it's important to eventually or at the end of it, like fall in line with the leader's decision unless you have an ethical issue with it. But like, it's not wrong as a consultant to say, hey, I disagree with the way that you're approaching making this customer successful. I've been working with them. Here are the ways that I would go about it, and to make an argument or to make a stance to go ahead and do that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And if you feel like you can't do that it to your boss or in your organization in general, it's easy for me to say, because I'm not in your life, to anyone listening. But to me, that sounds like a bad organization. There's a good way to do it. There's a wrong way to do it. But in general, there should be an expectation that if you've got a point of view, that it's going to be heard and considered, maybe not necessarily agreed with. But if you don't feel there's space to be heard when you've got pushback, that's not a great organization for your long-term future. Maybe you need it as a stepping stone for the next thing. Like, there's all kinds of reasons to stay in bad jobs for a period of time. But I would say that that's a bad sign for an organization that doesn't listen to its people.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Yeah. Okay, John. Well, that's our time. Any parting shots before we wrap up this inaugural episode?
No, I think we're good. I'm looking forward to whatever this podcast brings, and hopefully offering some beneficial at times consulting knowledge and insight to our listeners. I hope that we can get them engaged and bringing topics and ideas to us as well. So, you know, thanks for making this happen, and I'm excited for the future.
I am equally excited, John. This is going to be a lot of fun. This has been great, and thanks for listening, everyone, and we hope that you will join us for our future subsequent episodes. Have a good one. I haven't noticed this before.
Isn't that wild?
Crazy.
It's very wild. You could even do next 5 months, though. So, like, if you want, then it's truly a rolling 6 months. It's kind of bananas.